Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your host is Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor and founder of the Chalcedon Teacher Training Institute.
Singing to the Lord is not a suggestion. It is a command, both individually and corporately. Now, there are many verses that would back up what I just said, but I'll highlight a couple of them, particularly with a focus on the saints singing as a group. Psalm 95:1 says, "Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation." Colossians 3:16 says, "Let the message of Christ dwell among you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom through psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit, singing to God with gratitude in your hearts." And then lastly, not that, like I said, this is an exhaustive list because there's much more there. "Praise the Lord, sing to the Lord a new song, his praise in the assembly of his faithful people." And that's Psalm 149:1. But what is the Bible-approved style of music that we are to employ when believers meet together? Are the lyrics of songs more or less important than the melody itself? Should styles be reflective of modern tunes or stick to old established melodies? And finally, why does the triune God instruct us to sing? My guest today is Jeremy Wong, the pastor elder of Orchard Community Church in Campbell, California, in the midst of Silicon Valley. Jeremy has served in the U.S. military for 5 years in the Airborne Infantry. He holds a Bachelor of Music from Biola University, along with an MDiv from Faith Seminary. He's currently working on a Master's in Biblical Counseling. More importantly, he's also a husband and a father of two daughters. Thanks for joining me today, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me, and I'll be expecting my check in the mail.
Okay. Keep looking.
That's right.
Be patient and everything else. Okay. So everyone seems to have an opinion as to what the music should be for the weekly assembly of the saints. Now, you have given considerable thought and study to this area, and I've heard you preach on it extensively as you've been preaching through the Psalms.
Yes.
So to begin with, let my audience know a little bit about your background in music and how you came to pastor.
Wow. My background in music started when I was a kid. I don't remember how old I was, probably 5 or 6. My dad approached me and he asked, "Son, would you like to learn an instrument?" And I said, "Father, yes, I would. I would love to learn the drums." To which he replied, "Fantastic. Piano lessons start tomorrow." And so that was my entrance into the pool of music. Later on, I was born and raised in San Francisco, so my parents enrolled me in the Conservatory of Music. So my background is in a lot of classical piano. And about high school, I decided I had enough of classical piano and started dipping my toes into more pop stuff. And I was recruited to play in the church in which I grew up. And so there was the marriage in my life of both music and then the meeting on Sunday. That was my first time getting involved in that. And so a number of years later, you know, I made my way down to Biola to study in their, so they have two tracks. They have a music performance, and then they have what they call a worship track. And so I went to study there for my bachelor's, as you said. If the size and beauty of a building is any indication as to the importance, just know that at that time, at least, Biola worship students had a converted janitor's closet. The rest of the schools had those, you know, big, beautiful buildings. Anyway, so that's kind of the summary of my journey of in music and church service together.
Oh, okay. But somewhere in there, I'm guessing it's after Biola, you ended up in the Airborne Infantry. How'd that happen?
Yeah, that was right after Biola. I was initially interested in joining the military after 9/11. My mom kind of freaked out a little bit. I had a recruiter in the house. I took my test, and my best friend was in the house at the time, and he was just waiting, playing video games in the other room. And my mom came home, kind of assessed what was going on silently, grabbed him upstairs, and I think proceeded to yell at him a little bit. And so when he came back down, he's like, I think your mom's upset. You guys need to talk. So anyway, I put that on hold. And after graduating, I had no other commitments. So I figured, one, it was the best time because I had nothing else to do. And two, at the time, they had a program to repay student loans if you joined and sign over some stuff. So I thought that that'd be a pretty good financial decision too. And so I did join the military. The whole time also thinking that I would, it would not be a career for me, that I would return to ministry in some fashion. And I think maybe the follow-on question is like, what do you want to do in ministry after that? And my answer would be, I don't really care as long as it's a healthy church.
Okay. So a lot of people might think that's an odd journey. You know, you go to Biola, you're going to be a music minister or at least, you know, performance or something like that. And then you join the military. A lot of people who join the military who are musicians and they end up in the chorus or they end up in the band. Was that ever anything you wanted, or was it more like, no, 9/11 was the inspiration for me to want to do something. So tell me more about that.
I did not think about joining the chorus or the band. 9/11 was the inspiration, although I was a little late to the party. I also was inspired by, I can think, a couple of series. One was Band of Brothers, which was an incredible show about the airborne infantry. Incidentally, that's not why I joined. I joined on what they call an 18 X-ray contract, which is, you know, when you first sign up, you hit the Special Forces pipeline. But I, in the middle of the training, I got hurt, smashing my face into the ground while jumping out of a plane. And so that kind of derailed things, at least for me, on a human level. But God works these things out, as he does.
So you're the guy who jumped out of the planes.
I was, yeah.
Okay. This may sound off the point, and it probably is. Do you miss that?
I do not. Okay. I'm not very fond of heights. And I also thought, well, maybe doing that would help me get over that. But I was wrong. It did not.
Okay, so you're not the guy who puts the Christmas lights on the roof. Somebody else said.
No, and I'm not. Or if I have to do it, I'm like sweating profusely. And,
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So there has to be a philosophy of music, because anything we do, there's a philosophy attached to it. Based on your training, based on your experience, and based on what you're endeavoring to do, how would you categorize the important element of singing for the Christian church?
Yeah. I mean, I think like in your intro, it's incredibly important. And especially if we talk about, like, you know, opinions on styles and lyrics, or, you know, songs from this period or that period. I mean, first, we should all probably ask, what is God's opinion on the matter? Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately, we have it available to us in some of the passages that you read. And so, you know, I think, as you're aware of this, too, the way we do it at Orchard is we just consider God's opinion, and we try to put that in motion as best as we can. And so in the context of church music, I think one of the things that's either lost or, you know, just misplaced on purpose and replaced with something sub-biblical, right, is especially with a lot of popular brands, they have this, it's more of like this personal experience, or this just like chanting kind of a, it doesn't matter what the lyrics are, as long as you feel something. But that's not really what God has given us, right? And especially in Colossians 3:16, where the purpose of music in the congregation is to teach and admonish. And I you know, at least for myself, growing up in a church, I don't think I heard that one time in terms of the explanation of why we do music. You can point to the Psalms, and there's some descriptions of it. Okay. Sometimes they're used as calls to worship. Okay. But no one really explained it. Hey, teaching and admonishing one another through the singing of hymn songs and spiritual songs.
Right.
With all in the context of, right, like letting the word of Christ dwell richly. And so they're in our kind of like the mission statement and the boundaries with which we should really consider what the philosophy of music is supposed to be like. And especially in the context of letting the word dwell richly, that probably means we can't just sing any old song.
The Colossians 3:16 passage has a phrase in it that I think we can turn into something else. It says, admonish one another. So Paul seems to be interested in the one anothering part of Christian fellowship. And, you know, the power of music. I mean, if you asked anybody to sing the alphabet song, they could sing it. Most of them learned the alphabet by singing the alphabet song. So there's that idea that music has this ability, I think, I'm not sure if this is physiologically correct, building a rut in your head. And anybody who has ever been assaulted by music that they didn't like, I remember one time taking a kickboxing class. I liked the kickboxing, but that awful music was playing in my head between classes that I had to stop.
Yes.
And because the lyrics are just there and it's a rut. And if anybody, and I'm sure they have because I'm not unusual, has a song stuck in their head, depending on the song, it can be very irritating.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that God is saying, okay, there's going to be these ruts. So what are you going to be saying to yourself and each other with this phenomenon? Because it's not accidental. If it's a pretty much universal experience, then God must have designed it that way.
Yeah, I think so. And not only designed it, but, you know, instructed it that way for our gatherings. And not only in Colossians, but we see in Corinthians where, you know, it's not supposed to be an experience. It's supposed to be orderly. And as Paul is writing to them in their consideration between, you know, like spiritual gifts and tongues, the side he really chooses is that which is good for building up the church. And so as we think about the role of music and the building up of the church, I think you hit the nail on the head in talking about, you know, the fact that how many conversations have you had or have I had with people who not only struggle maybe with getting into the word, you know, every day to study and meditate on it, but to memorize it. And I, you know, I think of a particular person who had that struggle, but at the same time, this person had an amazing talent for memorizing movie scripts front to back. I mean, she could spew the entire movie, every part. You know, what was Paul writing about in Colossians? No idea. But songs are a great way for, you know, the church, the people of God to, you know, not just to wrap their minds around these ideas, but to like rehearse them regularly to a tune. And I think that also, you know, speaks to the song selection of the church. Like, are you singing songs that are Jesus is my boyfriend and my feelings are the center of the church experience? Or are they teaching and admonishing what the rest of scripture teaches and admonishes, right? That God is magnificent and glorious. And so I think it also, not just speaks to the importance of rehearsing these truths to myself, practicing them with one another as we gather, but also as in my role as a shepherd, that we would be careful about the types of songs that we sing. You know, and I'm thinking about the introduction that you said. There are definitely certain songs or groups of music makers that we would purposely avoid. I don't think they have the gospel, but B, because their songs are not helpful in teaching and admonishing one another.
So from your perspective, being a musician, and I know although you're the teaching elder as well, that you have a lot of say in terms of the music that they can pull from. In other words, it's not like you can only sing three songs. You have a whole playlist. And you do something that I thought years ago people should do. Like, why don't we know what the pastor is going to talk about? Why don't we know what songs we're going to sing so that we can sing them better? And for some reason, some people think that's just too stilted, you know, that somehow or other it's supposed to be spontaneous.
Yes.
But I don't know. When you stand before God, I don't know he wants us to be spontaneous. I think he wants to do what Paul said, be supportive for each other. And it is the one part in most services where we get to talk and we get to say things and we can look at each other. And I've noticed at times where we're singing a particular song and I see somebody crying. Mm-hmm. I know later on I'm going to go up and talk to that person because something was going on or someone is particularly happy. So I think there's a lot that takes place, but unfortunately, in a lot of gatherings, people use the part where we're singing to be late, because it's not really the most important part, as opposed to, no, I want to be there as we sing to each other.
Yeah. Or they sometimes they see it as like the warm up to the important stuff that's later on. And I think you're right. There's a giant swath of church culture which seems to practice, if not preach, that time of singing is a performance or concert. Part of my program at Biola, we had to go to different, they called it, styles of services. I remember there's one of them, I forgot the name of the church. It used to be in a hospital, right? Like they bought out a hospital building and converted it. Anyway, we went. And man, when they opened it, it was like smoke and lasers.
Oh, dear.
And this, giant show. I had no idea what they were singing, first of all. I didn't know what the songs were, so I couldn't sing along. But I think there's this attitude where it's a production, the band comes up, and they'll sing to you. And so then you train your people, right? Hey, they're singing to me. So am I just listening? And then they start thinking, oh, that's the warm-up to the important stuff. But that's not God's opinion. God's opinion is that the people who have gathered are the main voice of that portion, right? That we are to sing to one another. And so, like our orchard, we practice that as much as possible. And that's why we put out the playlist, because you need to be ready to come and sing, because that's your job. It's a good distance from where Orchard was when I first got there, in learning that, hey, the congregation is the main voice. And so we've had to teach that to them and practice that over and over and over. But I think we do that because it seems to reflect God's opinion on the matter the most.
Yes. So from your perspective, who's responsible to make the singing biblical? Are the musicians, or is it the congregation?
Yeah, probably both. So can I start with, sort of the history of Orchard? When I got there, the song catalog that we had at that time is not the one that you are familiar with. And so I think there was some of that attitude of like, here are the songs that we sing. We don't really know what they are. And when we show up, we might sing kind of depending on if I feel like it or not. So I think there's a responsibility on the elders, the teaching pastor, to really teach these things and to not left it unsaid and just assume that those who are gathering know their role in that portion of the service, because so many churches just assume, oh, they'll show up and they'll sing. But tell me why. Point to chapter and verse. What is God's opinion? Because I need to know that, and I need to practice that as much as possible. And so there's communication from the elders in terms of the purpose of not just the gathering itself, but the portions of the liturgy. And then as much as that is communicated and enabled, the individual members also have the responsibility to come and sing. So when we get together and you see the words and you hear the band playing, however much that is taught, you still have to open your mouth and sing about it.
Right. One of the things I noticed early on was that, yeah, you had microphones for those who sang.
Yes.
But they often back off from the microphones, and then the congregation is singing. So it very much reminded me, in the Old Testament, we have the Levitical musicians, the singers. And they they're bannered under the Levites, which means that they have a teaching ministry. That's what the Levites were all about. So do you think your philosophy is like a carry through of that practice of having Levitical musicians?
Yes. I don't know if I don't think we've ever talked about it that way.
Okay.
I wouldn't disagree with it, but I think the biggest impetus, at least from the elders, is it is your responsibility to sing, because it says to teach and admonish one another through songs.
Right.
So the text we've pointed to frequently is Colossians 3:16. This is your responsibility. We've mentioned it in members meetings over and over. We have that playlist that members could listen to. We put the songs out ahead of time so they can be prepared. Mm-hmm. And so there was a period of time, I think, before you guys got there where we just nonstop talked about it and begged and pleaded with people to come prepared with the songs,
I see.
Yeah.
See, I think a lot of people miss the value of group singing. And you mentioned 9/11 being your impetus to join the service. Well, post 9/11, baseball games on the seventh inning started singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
That's right.
And what's really interesting about that is it's probably one of the most joyous and one voice, even more so than the Star Spangled Banner, because mostly they bring in a performer to do it. And people, I mean, they might be singing it, but that's not the highlight. So you had people doing it. And like, why can people do it here? It's not an ungodly activity, but now we're among the saints. In other words, yes. I think we've lost the distinction that the saints are an actual real for real group, and they're not, everybody's not a saint.
Yes, I love that comparison. The one I go to is not the take me out to the ball game in the seventh inning, but you know, like when you go to concerts and whoever the artist is, they're playing, you know, the biggest hits. And there are always times during the song where they stop and they point the microphone out to the audience, right? And so they start singing the famous chorus or the famous verse. And I think, so I think to your point, you know, heathens do that really, really well. And they gather around songs, and every, it's a joyous occasion, and it brings people together, and they know why they're there. They're singing. And I think it's unfortunate in some senses that so many churches kind of miss out on that because they're too busy performing or doing something other, that they miss the divine intent behind the songs that are supposed to bring us together, right? Like we're not there for an experience. We're there in remembrance of the risen Christ.
And that's what has brought us together.
That's right.
I mean, I think you've probably experienced this. There are a lot of people who I meet in, you know, the assembly of the saints that I probably on my own volition wouldn't go out and say, I think I want to be that person's friend.
Yep.
And that's the whole point of every nation, every tongue.
Yes.
And that's what makes it different. But here's a question. Prior to the advent of concerts, because I don't really know when concerts started. I mean, I know that, you know, my grandparents and my parents would talk about big bands and people would have to go places. But then we had television.
Yes.
And so now music became something that only the professionals do. And there was this sense that, well, I don't have a good voice, so I shouldn't sing. Do you think that that has moved people away from the command to sing and the enjoyment and the edification of being sung to and singing to somebody else?
Yeah, I can understand that, but I think my answer is probably, I sure hope not. I mean, there are people in the congregation at Orchard who can't really carry a tune, and they would admit that themselves. But on Sunday morning when they're singing their guts out, like, who cares?
Right.
Yeah. And I think to your point where, you know, you talked about looking around on a Sunday morning and you see people, you know, tearing up and you want to ask them why. And I think part of the beauty of the congregation singing together over and over and over again is you get to know these people and then you get to know their stories. And so you look across and you don't have to wonder anymore because you know what that person has gone through, you know, the past week or the past month or whatever, and you know why they're tearing, but they're singing their guts out anyway. And that's meaningful for me as I am singing the same song because we're there together. It's not about the song, but the song is these truths that we're singing that you can sing them anyway. And I think it's the same for people who can't carry a tune, that they're not there to as a performative thing, but they're there to remember well, whether they can execute the technical skill necessary or not. They're there for the meeting.
The reason I brought that up is because I know that, you know, a lot of times if you're discussing theology, for example, oh, that's just way above my pay grade. It's like, no, yes. It shouldn't be above your pay grade. You're a Christian and you should know.
Yes.
God does not say, sing unto me if you have a good voice.
Yes.
Now, one of the things I found helpful, and I've said this to people over and over again, if you don't have a good voice, and by good, I mean that's pleasant and you even like hearing yourself. I have a daughter, but who has a beautiful voice. And when she sat next to me in church and she was singing and I was singing, I felt like my singing was enriched. So I have joked, yes, you can have people on the front leading saying, this is what we're going to do, but you should have the singers dispersed throughout the congregation so that other people are like, yes, you know, and they're more likely to sing out if someone who's singing out.
Right.
I think we've gotten to this idea because we can listen to music on the radio, and that music is something that has any purpose other than honoring God and speaking God's truth.
Yeah, I think you're right. We approach not just music, but the rest of the service with this consumer mindset, right? Like even if we were to consistently apply that to the preaching I'm here so you can give to me, or the greeting time. I'm here so you can greet me. But that doesn't seem to be God's mindset for his people or for the gathering. And so that's something that we need to shed before we come to the meeting. You know, this idea that it's for me. No, you're not really there for you.
Exactly. You're there for one another, you know, and that's how you actually honor God.
Yes.
You know?
If only that were God's opinion and he made it clear to us, we would have some sort of way to actually. Yeah, yes, right.
Yeah. So a terminology that you hear more, I would say in Reformed circles, but you don't hear it very much, are the terms the church militant and the church triumphant. The church triumphant being those who have gone before us, are now in the presence of the Lord, and those of us who are still here. And I look at congregational singing like we're singing with them and they're singing with us. And I don't think I'm just pretending. Sometimes when you really have that, you sense that this is the one voice praising the Lord.
Yeah, totally. If only there were descriptions of people, you know, singing from the throne room, or, you know, like some of the songs we use refer to that idea too, not just songs about heaven and the age to come, but the idea that as we sing, there are other saints across this globe who are singing with us, right? And it's not, we're not there because there's a show or because we're there to consume, but because God has brought us into this kingdom and that we have a gracious God that we should remember. And sometimes words are just not enough. So I have to sing because telling you about it just like this, that doesn't quite cover it.
Right, because you could recite the Psalms and okay, that's good because a lot of church will antiphonally do it. But years ago, there was a music artist who was a friend and she produced a lot of CDs for children. My daughter could sing the Lord's Prayer before she could say it.
Yeah.
And now, even now with a lot of the Psalms that they put to music, when I get to that Psalm, I'm singing it as I read it. And it's like, I used to think that's weird. I go, no, it's not weird because I remember it and it's those words are there. So I think one of the most important parts of congregational worship is including the children at that point, because you say, well, they may not understand all the words. Well, heck, I don't understand all the words all the time in terms of the real implication.
Yes.
But, you know, fidgety kids who are making that, make a joyful noise, get your kids singing. And I think that's something that the family should do prior to getting to this meeting, and so that their children can actually sing.
Yeah, I totally agree. I have the same experience with my girls. You know, we just play the songs over and over, and they have the talent or the patience, the capacity to listen to the same song a billion times in a row. And so it gets ingrained in them. And I think maybe you experience this too, but as a parent, even though they might not know the fullness of the lyrics that they're singing, there's opportunity there for us as parents to like, hey, check out what you're singing and let's talk about that together.
Right.
But the fact that they're getting that in their bones is really exciting to me.
Yeah. Now I have a son who's probably your age, if not a little older now. And I remembered that he could just recite commercials like perfectly. And I had read in a book that children have an amazing ability to memorize. And the person suggested, have him memorize the book of Proverbs. And so that's my son at the age of 8 or 9 could go through the first 8 chapters of Proverbs and say them perfectly.
Yeah. Did you do that in a, like it was a song or he just?
He just memorized it, you know, because I mean, I couldn't necessarily put it to music and such, but he was able to do it. And then one of the things I did with the two other kids is that, you know, okay, you're going to memorize the entire Midnight Ride of Paul Revere.
Yeah.
Like, what? My husband goes, I don't think I could do that. I'm not sure I could do that.
Yes,
but you know what? They could do that. And so this is how the word gets hidden in your heart because you say it over and over again.
Yeah. You know, my mom and her husband, they come down to see the grandchildren almost every Monday. And, you know, I don't remember when it was, but randomly, I think it was our youngest daughter, who is now 3. We were at the dinner table some random night, and she's standing there, and she just spews out Psalm 23 in her cute little voice. I had no idea that was even in that tiny little mind of hers. Right. But my mom had been just saying it to her once or twice every Monday, consistently. And that's just once a week. So if we apply that idea to your point, right? Like more consistently or for longer passages. If this 3-year-old can spew out Psalm 23, almost word for word. I totally agree with you that that's their fertile minds of, you know, just grabbing onto words. It's our responsibility to help exercise that for them.
Right. So biblically faithful songs, songs that are actually almost word for word from the scripture.
Yes.
It embeds there. And I found, like, I used to do this as we prayed before meals. We didn't sing it, but we prayed. And so, you know, thank you, Lord, for the food. And then the kids would start complaining about what was on the table. I said, excuse me, you just thanked God for this.
Yes, right.
You're going to take that back or whatever. That's right. Well, the same is true with singing, right? Whether you've taught them the Ten Commandments in song. And I even used to have my children memorize the catechism because that goes along with it, because then you can teach doctrine. But I know somebody who put the catechism to music.
So yes.
Music is important. And to go back to something I said earlier, do you think there's evil music and good music or bad music or sacred music or secular music? Do you even think those terms are reflective of anything meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be. Unless we were to make the case, right, that there's just sort of an morally neutral music, I guess. But I don't know if those are categories that is in the mind of God, right? I mean, he talks about like within the bounds of holiness, and that's not an indifferent or amoral topic, or the way that God sits on a throne and judges righteously, because that's of his character. So I don't know if we can render judgment that is amoral on music like that, or art in general. So there, I think there is definitely no sort of, you know, sacred or holy music. I don't know if that's interesting. I don't know if I've ever considered it evil, right? Like the two categories of anything that is not in the category of sacred or holy is considered evil. But that, I mean, there's the binary that we see throughout all of Psalms and all of scriptures. So I don't think I would be totally against that. But there, I mean, there's definitely music that is evil.
Yeah, I mean, what's generating it? You know, the scripture says, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it to the glory of God. So in that capacity, that's a good benchmark. And I have students who ask questions like, if you take a song that was written by a person who is ungodly, is it wrong to sing it? And I tend to not like to answer those questions other than with another question and says, okay, so if you do this, can you say I'm doing this to the honor and glory of God? And then the person, well, maybe not so much. I said, okay, well, you just answered your question. That's how we're going to approach it. But people get used to what they like. And so then you have the music preferences.
Yes.
So some like the very organ-like, which I think is beautiful. Some people, you know, so do you have a sense on how people might approach this topic if you're singing a tune that you don't particularly like, or you're not familiar with, or if it was up to you, they wouldn't do it?
Yes. Well, as you were talking about that question, the song that came to my mind was A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. Because I think that was an old bar tune that Martin Luther put words to, right? All 12 verses that he wrote or something like that.
Right.
Anyway, ask your question one more time.
Well, just in terms of the fact of, so you're...
Oh, styles.
Yeah, styles.
Yeah. I think people holding on to personal preferences is something that we all do, but it's also something we have to let go of in terms of especially when we meet on a Sunday, that meeting is not about our preferences. And so it's painful to see churches even have different services according to the style, because they've done that, right? This is our contemporary music. This is the traditional music service. And so now we've split the people of God based on their preferences, which is bonkers to me.
Yes.
And so that's not to say that there are songs that I like better than others, but at the end of the day, the rubric by which we have to measure this is something like, well, what is God's opinion? Colossians 3:16 says it has to teach and admonish the word of God. So is the song doing that? If so, then I can align my preferences with that. That is my preference. And whatever the melody might be, or the tune might be, or the instrumentalization might be, it is teaching and admonishing. So I can, as a believer, get behind that. Because what's good for me is not the instrumentation or anything like that. It's what is being taught and admonished.
Right.
And so I think that's got to be how the conversation is couched. Often it's not, right? It's like, no, these songs are better than your songs. So we should sing my songs.
So I would say that the lyrics are vitally important and the music serves to help embed the truth. But if I hear one more kid say, oh, yeah, I know that's terrible music, but I don't listen for the lyrics. I just listen for the beat. Yes. And it's just like, OK, so maybe you've convinced yourself of that. But nonetheless, there's lyrics that are going on in your head. So I think it's important, like you pointed out, preferences shouldn't dominate the decision. But if you've ever looked at like how they worship God in Africa, we wouldn't do it like that. They have their drums. They have their ways of singing. Some people worship God with an accordion. You know, I still remember those bumper stickers, play an accordion, go to jail. So some people don't like the accordion, right?
Yes.
So I think that congregations will come together probably based on similarities and whatnot.
Sure.
But as long as they're being taught, as long as those words are playing in their head, then you really don't need a radio, do you? Because the word's hidden in your heart.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think to your point, you know, like if I were to walk into a service dressed in the traditional clothing of a different country, I mean, eyebrows probably would be raised. And that would be distracting for some people.
Right.
Right. And so there's like a cultural element that we kind of just sort of agree to. But at the same time, I think the point that we try to make is that our culture's not really about the dress or the length of service or the style of music or whatnot, but there are other things that we want dominating the culture in the church, right? Like, how do we honor God and serve him with all our heart, soul, and mind? And then how do we serve others and act as if though God has done something about something, other people are more important than you. Yeah. And so if I'm pointing to the preferences, then I'm just ignoring all those things. And so the culture of the church should not be, what is the world doing? Let's do that.
So do you think in general, music instruction has waned and that's part of, because I remember growing up, we had music class.
Yeah. In the church?
Well, I mean,
or just in general?
This is a different subject. A lot of Christians will put their children into institutions of learning that don't love God and don't want to teach his commandments. In general, is that just as important as the soccer game, having music instruction from your point of view?
Yeah, I think so. But I think part of it is, as an Asian American, the joke for us, right, is like whether we're going to learn the piano or the violin.
Yes.
Because that's just the cultural thing. But I think an even higher level view of maybe what you're getting to is that parents have a limited amount of like extracurricular activity. And so they spend it on things like sports and stuff like that. But what if, I don't know, what if we also train children in worshiping properly and being able to contribute to meetings? So while being good at soccer is good, being able to contribute well to the culture of worship in the church is probably even more important. But we don't spend much time really like thinking about that as an extracurricular activity that we want to commit time and energy and effort to. There's no traveling worship ball.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
Yeah.
But I remember it was more customary that somebody was taking an instrument. And I always wonder why we don't have spontaneous hymns and songs coming out of the people of God. I once thought, well, maybe we should just have a music contest or a song contest and have people contribute what they have to say so that we get people thinking that, oh, I can contribute to something like this.
Yeah, I like that idea. And I do think it also made me think of there's a church out in DC where they actually have classes for their members to learn to like read music. And so when they print the music in the bulletin for the Sunday, they learn more and more to be able to follow along and do the participation. Right. So I don't think that's exactly what you're talking about in terms
of. No, but it's not unlike what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
understand that when in the hymnals where they have, now I'm not, I've had somebody call me, I'm a non-playing musician because I'm so interested in the whole subject of music and such, but to have harmony,
you
need more than one person.
Totally.
Nobody, when you hear a song that's sung in harmony, no one person can do that. So it automatically instructs the idea that we're doing this together because without it, I don't get the richness of it. And I do think that instruments provide that now in some way, but I think that it could be enhanced, of course, by people actually learning how to sing.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
One last thing.
Sure.
You talked about the idea of coming to worship. And I think a lot of people miss the idea that our coming together, obviously we're praising God because that's what our life should be. So our lives should be worship. Worship should not be excluded to Sunday morning from this time to this time. I like to look at, and I have looked at it for a while, meeting with the saints on Sunday is like going to a gas station and getting your tank filled up. And so now you're ready for the week. And if you live in this world, especially we both live in Silicon Valley, you're going to be bombarded by difficulties, challenges, etc. And that's where you go to refill and replenish. But you can't do that by watching something on television. And you can't do that even just by going to a place, sitting there and not engaging. I think singing allows us to engage so that the whole of our lives are worshipful.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the singing portion is also maybe like an indication of how well you've been practicing that through the week.
Yeah.
Right? Like, but the participating in the saints. And I think, to your point, even outside worship as, you know, an equivalent of music in the service, there's a book by Ed Welch that talks about this idea where church members ought to think about intentionally how they will do a spiritual good to other members to whom they're committed on the Sundays. And so he says something to the effect of like, start in the parking lot. Where are you going to park? Who are you going to sit next to?
Yep.
You know, like, who are you going to greet? Who are you going to pray for? How you follow up with them? So it's not just the music that we should participate in, but the life of the church in which we are faced towards others, not my preferences first in terms of, I want to sing these songs, but, you know, how can, I think it'd probably be more effective if everyone had the attitude of like, how can I fill your tank?
Yes.
Because I have also been individually filling my tank, right, throughout the week. So now that we're here all together, let's leverage this time, because we're not all together all the time, but let's leverage this time to fill each other's tanks.
Exactly.
That's part of the consumerism that's dominated, and we've lost that a little bit, you know?
Yeah. So I wonder if somebody comes up to you and says, Jeremy, I really enjoyed the music. Do you feel like that's not what I wanted to evoke out of you?
Yes. You know, I think it depends on the person, you know, like if it was a new person, I might just say, thanks. But if it was a member of the church and we've had relationship of a few years of getting to know each other, that's usually not the comment. It was, hey, this song was meaningful for me because this kind of situation or something like that.
So it's the anti-consumer mentality. We don't come to just have somebody, like going to a movie, you don't interact with the film.
That's right.
You know, so, but this is different.
This is different. Yeah.
I appreciate you taking the time. I've seen you live it. So that's kind of why I wanted to talk to you about it. And as a result, I mean, this is a subject for 20 years I've been looking at, and I see that it's taking shape in some of the books that you had told me that were instrumental to you have helped me see that I'm not original in my idea, but there are actual musicians who are putting their hands to the plow to this to accomplish that. So
definitely,
I hope we've maybe encouraged people to sing for an additional reason.
I hope so too. I really hope so too.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Listeners, outofthequestionpodcast@gmail.com is how you reach us. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit calcedon.edu.